Welcome to the Anti-Woke Podcast.
Anti-woke, 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 yeah. Anti-woke, 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 yeah. Let's do this. The Anti-Woke Podcast.
Mass stabbings are the new mass shootings. Some guy killed six in a mall in Sydney, Australia, stabbing people. And I guess because of the number killed and Australia is, you know, kind of like America, our little buddy. So it got onto the national news. And it's interesting for a couple of reasons. We had a mass stabbing in America, I think like a month ago. I think in Rockport, Illinois. And then some people who are of the opinion that all the guns should be taken away from Americans will point to Australia as the blueprint for how to do it. They had a mass shooting 20, 30 years ago and took away most everyone's guns. And then they haven't had, I mean, they didn't have mass shootings before that, and they haven't had them after it either. But apparently they still have mass stabbings. So I guess if someone's like, we need to take away everyone's guns, look at what's happening in Australia, it's wonderful, you can come back with, they just had a mass stabbing that killed six. And then a female cop shot the stabber and killed him. It takes a good girl with a gun to stop a bad guy with a knife. Or to stab. And then there was a mini Black Lives Matter incident. A 15-year-old black boy got shot by a cop because he was going around the neighborhood with a fake gun. I don't think there's going to be riots. People pretty much all agree shouldn't go around swinging a gun. I think he was pointing it at different people's houses. I never saw a picture of the gun. I don't know if, you know, if he took off the orange cap of an airsoft or what. That was what happened in one of the Black Lives Matter incidents that led to riots, years before George Floyd. Some kid, I think it was like a 12-year-old who was also 6 feet tall, was swinging around a gun at a park where he'd taken off the orange cap. Here's a clip of the 15-year-old's mom.
Akron Police Department needs to be held accountable for the excessive force that you use on our black babies.
And then another crime that got on the nightly news was a guy stole a fully loaded semi-truck and drove it into a DMV in Texas. And that fooled my racial gaydar. I was like, that is a very working class thing. I'm going to guess Hispanic, you know, Texas. But it turned out to be a black guy. I mean, not just anyone can steal a semi-truck. Like, the way to shift gears is something that requires training. So, you can't just jump in and go. Although, one of my listeners talked to me on Spotify and was like, oh, they got automatics. It's easy. I don't know. But it turns out this guy, he had gone to the DMV the previous day to get his CDL, commercial driver's license, renewed. And they rejected him. So, he showed them. A 90-year-old lady got killed. She must have been, I think she's in the waiting room. I mean, she'd lived a full life. And sometimes you're just like, you're at the DMV, you're waiting, you're like, God, I'd rather be dead than wait any longer. And then the parents were sentenced to 10 years from some white high school boy who shot up his school. And this is the first time parents have gone down for a school shooting or shooting that their kid did. And they had bought him the gun and people felt they didn't lock it up good enough. So we'll see if this opens the floodgates for the parents of every kid who goes out mass shooting. I mean, mass shootings are, 75% to 85% done by black men. So I think people will not like the result. This one was okay. I don't think we're going to replicate this kind of charging and convicting, but we'll see. Ben Shapiro mentioned the Overton window when he was talking about how Candace Owens got fired from the Daily Wire. So I just figured I'd look up the Wikipedia page and read it. So, the Overton window is the range of policies politically acceptable to the mainstream population at a given time. The term is named after the American policy analyst Joseph Overton, who proposed that an idea's political viability depends mainly on whether it falls within this range rather than on politicians' individual preferences. According to Overton, the window frames the range of policies that a politician can recommend without appearing too extreme to gain or keep public office given the climate of public opinion at that time. And so you can see there, originally it was all about politicians and the policies they could propose. Politicians, policies, propose. Pumpernickel. But I would say, today what it really means is just, what are the ideas that are acceptable? And so, you know, Ben Shapiro, whatever Candace Owens was saying about Israel, he was like, you know, that speech, those ideas, those are outside the Overton window, they're not acceptable. You're fired. And so some people fight over stuff within the Overton window, but a lot of what people do is they try and shift the Overton window. So you go to one side of it, and you know, you got your ideas that are just on the edge, or maybe just over the edge. Anyways, you start promoting the stuff that is just on the edge, I guess within the window, and then you try and get that thing to be the center of the Overton window, allowing what used to be more extreme to be within the Overton window. What's an example? You know, Black Lives Matter, don't kill innocent black people, defund the police. Oh, now defund the police is in the middle. You know, decarceration, let everyone in prison out. Oh, the black neighborhoods are going to shit. It's shifting back the other way. Defund the, you know, decarceration is out of the window. Oh, defund the police is out of the window. Oh, doing anything at all is out of the window. I was looking up the term deep state the other day, and the Wikipedia article has a graph where the up-down axis is good to bad, and the left-right axis is liberal to conservative. And you can't describe a graph in a podcast, so don't worry about it. But for instance, like, you know, one quadrant of the graph would be stuff the conservatives think is bad, and another quadrant might be stuff that liberals think are good. And then it's like, how much? Like, how bad do you think it is? And how conservative are you? And I don't know who came up with this stuff, but it allows you to kind of compare things from, I don't know, from both sides. For instance, maybe conservatives think that entrepreneurs are pretty good. And then maybe liberals think, you know, their equivalent is regulators are pretty good. But then you go to the corners to see the bad stuff, you know. Conservatives, what they think is the most bad is the deep state. And then liberals, what they think is the most bad is the military-industrial complex. And those things are not exactly the same groups of people, but there's a lot of overlap. It's kind of like liberals and conservatives both hate the same thing, but they give it a different name. So deep state, military-industrial complex. There's another thing that's kind of like those two, which is called the blob. Also, the foreign policy establishment blob or the foreign policy blob. And so I'd like a term that puts all these three things together. I haven't heard that one yet. But like, for instance, pro-war politicians, they're in the deep state. They're also a part of the military-industrial complex. They're also part of the blob. And then the military-industrial complex, that has, like, you know, companies and arms manufacturers emphasized. The deep state has just government employees in general emphasized, you know, so it could be the environmental regulations or something too, besides just military. And then the blob has a lot of journalists in it, and think tanks and NGOs. Basically, a lot of times, well, okay, so like the New York Times, they have a few reporters who are just pro-America war, rah-rah, and, you know, so they're part of the blob, they're powerful, and their job is to get the American public to support war. And then, you know, so Raytheon is a famous arms manufacturer. Raytheon pays money for a think tank which writes papers about how we're going to give $60 billion to Ukraine, and then that paper goes to the politicians, and they put it forward as a bill, and it becomes law. And various journalists try to convince the public that, yeah, if they pass this law, don't throw those politicians out on their ear. It was an unprovoked war. America's just. But anyways, I'm just trying to get this stuff straight in my head. And you're along for the ride. So, military-industrial complex, deep state, the blob. Military-industrial complex has more arms manufacturers, the deep state has more government employees, and the blob has more journalists, But basically, they're all the same thing, hawkish foreign policy. Okay, here's how it works. Here's why the mainstream media lies to the public to keep Joe Biden in office so that Joe Biden can take money from the taxpayers and give it to the arms manufacturers. Like, the Ivy League journalists are all a bunch of lefties. Why would they be doing this? And it's not just Trump derangement syndrome. So the big index funds, BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, probably a couple more, they own 20 to 50% of every company in the Fortune 500, right? That's where your 401k money goes. It goes to them, and then they buy stock. And like I say, this is every company in the Fortune 500, and, you know, doesn't mean they don't buy the next 500 smaller companies. They buy them all. So BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, they own enough stock to control, you know, CBS and their news division, ABC and their news division. They also own Raytheon and McDonnell Douglas and Boeing and all the arms manufacturers. Or, you know, large chunks of all of them. So some left-wing reporter at CBS is like, oh my God, this proves it. America provoked Russia on purpose to invade Ukraine so that we could sell weapons. And they go to their boss, and their boss goes to their boss's boss until you get to the top of CBS. And that guy's like, oh, well, you know who can hire and fire me? Well, it's Larry Fink of BlackRock. And BlackRock owns Raytheon and all the companies that make money off of selling arms. And BlackRock is currently randomly selecting companies that it owns huge amounts of to fire all the white people and put in diversity. And the head of CBS, he doesn't ask Larry Fink, hey, do you want me to blow up this whole war narrative and have it mess you up on all your arms manufacturers that you own? I mean, he knows the answer. It would be illegal. It would be insider trading or whatever if he asked. So you don't ask. I mean, it's funny. That only took a couple of minutes to say. Like, everyone should just be like, remember, the media companies are owned by the same people who own the arms manufacturers. And it applies to anything. You know, if CBS does a story on chicken, Tyson chicken, they should be like, and remember, BlackRock owns 12% of Tyson chicken and 8% of CBS. And Vanguard owns 8% of Tyson Chicken and 12% of CBS. There basically should be a disclaimer on anything they say. The April 6th episode of the Gist podcast was talking about the podcast implosion at NPR. And just in general, the problems that NPR is having. And NPR teams up with public radio stations in big cities to create a lot of their programming. And he mentions that the stations in Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York have all laid people off recently. I mean, I think we're talking the last 18 months. And he provided some numbers. I think 2022 is the last year or latest year that numbers are available. So as far as actual radio station listeners, NPR had 29 million in 2019. And it's down to 24 million in 2022. So 29 million down to 24 million. And in about the same time frame, their podcast listenership went from 11 million to 8 million. So down maybe 20% of the radio listeners and 30% of the podcast listeners. And the CEO of NPR is, you know, being fired, is leaving, you know, they don't specify exactly, but he got a 4-year contract starting right after George Floyd was killed, and he was supposed to have 9 more months, but he's leaving now. And while he was CEO, he has said, for instance, quote, diversity and equity and inclusion is my North Star. So basically, the most important thing for him as a CEO is discriminating against white males. And he succeeded. In 2021, only 22% of the people they hired were white. And I think that's white. I think that's all whites, or maybe that's just white males. I'm not sure if he let white females in. I think maybe white, what do they say? Male, pale, and stale, you're out. And the gist, they were talking about, an example was Invisibilia, which I never listened to, but it was a famous hot podcast, you know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And it was like people from This American Life and some other super famous NPR show, they split off from those shows and created Invisibilia. And I think it was kind of a scientific show. It was like, you know, the invisible things in your mind that lead to outcomes in the world. But it wasn't constantly about race. And so that was a show. It was white women who were in charge of that. And there might have been, I don't know, that was the top two. Probably some white men beyond that. But anyways, they switched out all the people who worked on that show and they replaced them. I mean, I looked up a picture. It was all women. You know, there was a fat black woman. There was a woman wearing a hijab. You know, there was multiple lesbian haircuts. 8 women total. They're out on their ass now because that show got canceled. And I don't feel like going and getting the clip, but they played a clip where someone created a TV show where they put a camera on a slow-moving train. And it was just supposed to be a calming TV show that just showed you, I think, the California countryside as the train just drove along. And so, like, whatever, the woke version of Invisibilia went and talked to the guy who created the TV show, and they were like, you know, isn't it your white privilege that you have time to watch a slow-moving train when history of, and they mentioned, like, slavery, and, you know, they said the words slavery, colonialism, several other key phrases. It was just a microcosm of what happened to NPR. So basically, the question is, did NPR... We know it got woke. Did they go broke? The answer is yes, they did go broke. Because the listeners of NPR are old white people. And basically, they're like, you know, what would a 25-year-old black lesbian, what is she interested in? That's going to be what our shows are. And just, you know, some old white people listened. But anyways, less of them. Less of them listened to them before. And they played a clip from another show they created called Louder Than a Riot, which... I don't know. It was like hip-hop. It was like hip-hop and talking about how beat someone's ass. I don't know. I think there was cussing. It was not NPR's bag. Basically, there's this saying. It's like, you know, they'll make a black Little Mermaid or something. And if you're like, I don't want a movie with a black Little Mermaid. They're like, well, this movie isn't made for you. It's made for other people. And so basically, NPR was like, they made... shows that were not for NPR listeners, they were for other people. They were for the people they wish were their listeners, not who were their listeners. And what's kind of interesting, like, the two ladies who created Invisibilia and then had the show taken away from them because they weren't diverse enough, well, they went back to This American Life and whatever the other lady was from. So I don't have numbers to prove it, but I think this is the same thing happened at Netflix and Disney Plus, NPR, probably, I don't know, just tons and tons of, well, any place that was doing streaming, video, or podcasts, the same thing happened. The pandemic happened. Venture capital money bet huge on these things, and just money flowed in, and they hired people like crazy. And it was at the same time as George Floyd, so who are you going to hire? Well, they hired, you know, to exaggerate, nothing but black lesbians to make up for slavery. And I think when they did this, you know, there's always been this idea that, you know, black lesbians are not in charge of the latest Law and Order TV show because of discrimination. Anyway, so we put that to the test. The answer is because they're not good at it. If you give it to them, they create an inferior product. And so I think, like, all these jobs were created for your black lesbians, and then all those black lesbians are... out on their ass, don't let the door hit you. And all the original people, you know, basically like Jews and other forms of white people, whatever, they're still there. They're the ones who are still making content in this reduced content future. And so John Lansing, whose North Star was not hiring white people, basically he's not the man to fire all the black people. You can't be that person. It can't be the same person. So we'll see. He got replaced by a white woman, and We'll see what she does. I think maybe you need to go two CEOs. You can't fire all the black people with this white woman that you replaced. But I think the next one, the one after her, can fire everyone. Well, NPR hasn't given up on all this woke horse crap. Here's an ad I heard Thursday morning.
And that's up first for Thursday, April 11th. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Consider this from NPR. The anti-diet and body positivity movements promote a message of self-acceptance and health at any size. So what happens when big food companies co-opt that message for profit? Listen to the podcast, Consider This.
Crypto's back, baby. Oh, God, I don't want to talk about crypto. But Bitcoin is up times four since its low. Other coins are up, 10 times or more from their low. FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried, that crypto exchange that was stealing all their money and then he got thrown in prison. They're paying out money to the investors who we thought were going to lose all their money. But in fact, FTX still owns like some stock in Anthropic, which is basically the number two AI company after OpenAI. And they also own some crypto, which, is now worth a ton. And so, say you owned, one Bitcoin and you had it in your account at FTX. And it was worth, $20,000 when that company declared bankruptcy. But now it's worth $80,000. And then the company is like paying out the money. Do they give you 20 or do they give you 80? I mean, obviously, they give you 20 because I think it's their decision. And you're like, don't give me the cash. Just, give me the coin that I owned. Anyways, people are complaining. That's fine. But the Moment of Zen podcast is talking about it. They're talking about an economic idea called an attention economy. So in a post-scarcity world, you end up in an attention economy. So, when people talk about a post-scarcity world, the example they use is Star Trek, which has like that little, I think it looks like a microwave, and you just tell it, oh, I want a steak, or I want a coffee, or whatever. And if you say you want a coffee, it creates a cup full of hot coffee. It doesn't just make the coffee, it makes whatever the hell you want that will fit in a box the size of a microwave, and you can have it. So basically, nothing is scarce. Like right now, gold is worth tons of money because it's scarce. But if you had one of those boxes, you'd be like, make me a brick of gold. And be like, yeah, fine. Brick of gold is the same as a cup of coffee, same as anything. And that would be a post-scarcity world. And we're not really there yet. But, stuff is pretty damn cheap from China. At least for people in America. Like if you live in America and you're buying stuff off of Temu, T-E-M-U, if you haven't tried that site, check it out, cheaper than Amazon. It's almost like we are in a post-scarcity world. Like I spent $17 on that site the other day and got so many drill bits and a vacuum cleaner and all sorts of other stuff for like $17. Cordless vacuum cleaners were $5.50. I was trying to get above $15 to make the shipping free. So I was like, sure, I'll take an extra cordless vacuum cleaner. Like drones that have cameras that record whatever, your neighbor changing clothes. You can get drones for $12. Anyways, it's like we're almost in a post-scarcity world. Except for housing, I know. But as we get closer to a post-scarcity world, what has value? Like what's the thing that's left? If you're truly in the Star Trek world, what is left? The only thing that's left is your attention, your time. Could be women's basketball has value. But basically, if people are willing to give their attention to crypto, it doesn't matter any of the underlying principles. In an attention economy, crypto's super valuable, has true value, in an attention economy, anything that has your attention has true value. Like, that is the only thing that has true value. I guess the point is, in a post-scarcity world, what is still scarce? The only thing is attention. Then they're talking about the phrase, if the product seems free, then you are the product. And I've heard that before. Usually they talk about social media, like, oh, it's free to use Facebook? Well, that's because you, user, are the product. So think of, like, television. The television channel manufactures the viewer, and then the advertiser is the consumer and buys the viewer. So TV is a factory. The actors and the directors are the factory workers. Off of the assembly line comes viewers who are shipped to the store, and then the advertisers go to the store and buy those. And Facebook would basically be the same. Although Facebook has an ad-free version that's like 10 euros a month in Europe. And Twitter obviously has $8 and $16 things you can pay. So I think if you ask kids today, what do they want to be when they grow up? A lot of them will say something like YouTuber. I think, you know, basically internet influencer. And this goes into a theory that I'm trying to develop about how the internet is a meritocracy. Which, you know, did this have to be a racial thing? I don't think it had to be that being qualified for your job is, you know, racialized. But, you know, George Floyd, and in general, just, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion, starting in the universities and spreading out to the corporations, it's, you know, it's meritocracy versus diversity. That's become the dichotomy. And then media companies went crazy with the diversity, and now they're going out of business. And, you know, what's putting them out of business? The internet, the meritocracy. Like NPR had an explosion of radio shows and podcasts created by, you know, basically black lesbians. And now the CEO in charge of that has lost his job, and all those shows are going away, and the people are losing their jobs. And then, you know, what do people like on the internet? To be very general, hot white chicks who speak English, and boys who are good at video games. And I know there are articles complaining about the lack of diversity in those two spaces, but I feel like it should be at a fever pitch. Like, this is what's happening. It's not at a fever pitch. Well, that's just a theory I'm working on. I need some numbers to really tell that story. Let's go back to crypto. So Bitcoin and Ethereum, that's the two famous cryptocurrencies. And basically, if you're one of the, you know, number three, who even knows? So anyways, if you're one of the two that people know the name of, you're set for life there. And then there's the other one I've been hearing about lately is Solana. And I think Solana was the one created by FTX. I don't know. FTX was sitting on a bunch of Solana. That's the one where people, you know, they're paying people back $12 per Solana or something. And Solana is currently trading at 180. That's the difference from the day FTX declared bankruptcy and they froze valuations or whatever to today with the big run-up in crypto. So what does Solana have going for it? Well, first off, I've heard of it. Slate Money mentioned it. I mean, even if you're just famous because you're part of the biggest bankruptcy, you know, pyramid scheme ripoff in history. I mean, maybe that's all that matters. At least you're famous. But this podcast is saying that also there's something called developers. I don't know what a developer does, but there are developers involved with each crypto coin, and you want an active developer community, and Solana has that. And don't quote me that it's part of exactly what how it has to do with FTX. Anyways, basically, the attention of the developers makes the cryptocurrency valuable. And there's other things that are supposed to make cryptocurrencies worth more. Like there's something called a stable coin, which means that it is backed by real dollars. There's a certain amount of cash set aside in a bank account, hopefully not FTX's bank account, that sits there to back up the currency. So the currency is always worth at least as much as the dollars set aside, stable coin. And then there's other things about, you know, the cryptocurrency uses a lot of electricity, so some of them use less electricity, which can be a benefit. I think that means lower fees. When you want to transfer a coin from you to someone else, the amount of electricity required to do that costs money and creates fees, and so you can have lower fees if you use less electricity. And probably 10 other things that I don't know about. And according to this podcast, people's attention is more important than being good at those other things. I know Bitcoin is famously terrible about electricity, like uses more electricity than Argentina or whatever. But I guess I'm going to make a prediction. Trump needs a cryptocurrency. He did this Truth Social stock market thing. It's kind of like that. And he had previously done, I can't remember the name, but he did like digital trading cards or something, and that I think is now worthless. But he needs to, you know, if it goes by famousness, if attention is what is the currency of the realm, then Trump has got that in spades. He needs to do the cryptocurrency thing correctly. It's probably not that easy. Then they're saying that one theory has it that crypto is a pseudo-religion. My podcast used to be called Religion of Woke because I think wokeness is a religion. It's kind of, you know, a lot of people lost their Christianity and they had to go find something else. They found wokeness. But apparently, for all the cryptocurrencies that get huge, there's usually a messiah or whatever, a person whose charisma kind of determines the value of the currency. And Elon Musk, he used to talk about Dogecoin, which has a picture of a doggy. And so that probably made it value to be associated with Elon. Bitcoin's creator is called, I think, Yakutoshi Moto or something. It has like a Japanese name, but I don't think it's actually a Japanese person. No one knows who it is, so that's almost the best kind of messiah. But obviously, Trump could jump in on that kind of situation. I mean, maybe Biden too. LeBron. I guess, are we about to see every famous person have their own cryptocurrency? Well, and to get a little deep, Felix on Slate Money once said that gold is not an investment, it's gambling. The difference between an investment and gambling is the investment produces money. So like if you buy a stock for $100 and it gives you $1 a year in dividends, then that's an investment. Because now you got your $100 stock, which, you know, you can buy and sell that. You can sell it and get your money back. But it also produces something, money. Whereas gold, the value, you know, gold may go from 300 to 2 grand, like it has done in the last decade or something. But gold itself does not produce money. It's just, it goes up and down. It's gambling. But I don't know what this does with gold, but with crypto, if you credit the idea of an attention economy, then crypto gets attention. Maybe it creates attention. So it's not just gambling on crypto, you're actually investing. Slate's TBD podcast had a guy on talking about how Google search sucks now. And he was blaming it on AI. Like, for example, if you go do a Google search for air purifier reviews, you get a bunch of mainstream media outlets like USA Today and Rolling Stone who have articles like top 10 air purifiers. And it's just AI generated crap where there wasn't anyone at Rolling Stone testing out air purifiers. It's just AI generated crap that AI reads the internet and then provides basically a bunch of affiliate links where if you click on that and go to Amazon and buy the thing, then Rolling Stone gets money. And so Google search does suck. I don't know if you're aware of it. People are slowly getting aware that Google search used to be good and give them the information they wanted, and now it doesn't. But the reason why, or, you know, my explanation for at least part of it, is it's their trusted sources policy. Now this is something, I think they created it for YouTube. But basically, if you go to YouTube and you type in Israel, or, you know, flat earth or whatever, they don't want to, you know, in quotes, spread misinformation. So what they do is they just go, we're going to create a list of trusted sources, CNN, ABC, NBC, MSNBC, you know, a bunch of acronym alphabet soup. And so if any search has any sort of controversy around it, we're only going to give you links or videos from these so-called trusted sources. Basically sources that can be trusted to lie to you and tell you the false narrative that the people in power want you to believe. And so they do this on Google search and Google News also. Like, you know, Google News used to have Breitbart. Anyways, they used to have What is it? I think I have this stat. It's now Google News is now 66% left and 5% right. Anyways, they used to just provide you the best article. They no longer do that, and just general searches too. But here's the thing. So, say you're Rolling Stone and you're borderline going to go out of business. You know, no one's buying the physical magazine subscription to Rolling Stone. Well, you can take advantage of this thing where Google searches tend to put you towards the top. You know, and I think, you know, it used to be just like, okay, only do it to Israel and abortion and, you know, flat earth. But I think just the number of things that Google is like, oh my God, you know, if someone's searching for cats, well, you know, Donald Trump's daughter just bought a cat. Now they're going to be reading articles about Trump. Okay, fine, put cats on the list. And basically it's getting to the point where it's like, fine, just put everything on the list. Only trusted sources. And so Rolling Stone and all these other trusted sources are like, oh, we can make up an AI-generated article about air purifiers and basically sell air purifiers from Amazon and make money off of it. Well, you know, just go use Bing. Anyways, Bing is doing the same thing. That's Microsoft's version of Google search. I went and did a race and crime statistics graph. That's what I typed in. Search, I did it on Google, on Bing, and I did it on Yandex. And Google and Bing, I mean, they've done a bunch of like by hand fine tuning. So all you get from that is like, you know, the once again, bullshit, fake narrative stuff, but that white people commit hate crimes against black people. That's basically all you get from those two. And then Yandex actually gave you the right stuff. Yandex is Russia's version of Google. And I don't know, I'm gonna have to check them again because I feel like, you know, every few months I'll go check Yandex and I feel like they're also woke. But they weren't this time, so I don't know. I'm looking for, you know, I'm a 2010 liberal. I'm looking for a 2010 Google search option. There's now two ways we can stop climate change anytime we want. So I've mentioned that we can put sulfate aerosols into the upper atmosphere. It reflects sunlight, cools things off. And this isn't tinfoil hat stuff. You know, NASA's got papers on it, etc. I mean, they're working on it. It sounds like we could have global warming stopped cold in about 12 months if we went full steam ahead with it. But of course, you know, climate change activists would be very upset if we stopped it. But anyways, the other way we can stop it, and apparently this will take 10 years, is something called enhanced weathering. So over the last billions of years, the way that CO2 gets out of the atmosphere is when it rains, the rain picks up CO2 from the atmosphere. That turns into carbonic acid. It's kind of like acid rain, but it's natural. It's always there. It's fine. And so the carbonic acid rain hits mountains and washes and eats away at the rocks of the mountains. And then that flows down the rivers into the sea. And then that stores the CO2 at the bottom of the ocean. Well, that's normal weathering. So enhanced weathering means that basically what you have to do is grind up a mountain into like a fine powder and just throw it in the ocean. And the CO2 that's brought down by the rain will find that powder in the ocean and stick to it and then go to the bottom of the sea. And you may have to grind up a few mountains. You may have to grind up mountains on the equator. So, you know, black and brown mountains. And it would take 10 years probably to grind a mountain up. But basically, this isn't just stopping global warming. This reverses it. Just, you know, how much CO2 do you want to take out of the atmosphere? Well, that's just how many mountains you grind up. And again, this ain't tinfoil hat stuff. They're working on it. But no one's working on any of this stuff too hard. Right-wingers are having success in Argentina and Slovakia. I'm getting this from the TLDR News Global and TLDR News EU podcasts. So some months back, Argentina elected a new president, Javier Milei. People call him like the Trump of Argentina. I think largely because he has big hair. And he would like swing around a chainsaw at political rallies. And Argentina is interesting It's very white. It's on the southern part of South America, so it's not a hot jungle. I think it has the same climate as like the Midwest. They're famous for growing cows, but their governments are always screwed up, and they'll go communist one time and something else the next. So anyways, Javier Milei, he's in there and he's like, we're gonna throw out the communism, we're gonna privatize the state-owned industries, and we're gonna whip this country's economy into shape. And that's gonna involve a recession and 200% inflation. And like in America, that would not fly. But Argentina is like, what else is new? We got recessions every other year, 200% inflation. Yeah, that kind of thing happens pretty frequently. So anyways, that stuff happened, but however that is supposed to be, that's what he wanted to have happen, and you need this short-term pain to get to the long-term gain. Well, it's been going on for a few months, and the long-term gain is starting to happen. So, compared to America, they're all screwed up, and they still are, but I guess things are getting better. If he can keep this up for a while, who knows? Well, Argentina deep state will probably throw them in jail, but how about Slovakia? I think they're an Eastern European country that's in the European Union. And they just had some elections, and they voted in a right-wing person who doesn't want to aid Ukraine. And the biggest issue in the election was French President Macron had said that he wants to put, NATO boots on the ground in Ukraine. And I think that's because, France is far away from Russia, so it sounds like a good idea to get involved. Whereas Slovakia is closer to Russia, and they're part of NATO, and they're like, no, we don't want to fight Russia. And so I think this right-wing government is anti-EU. And reminder, the EU has their big elections in June. So we're going to see if they, if the right-wingers can ever get in there and stop all the migrants and who knows what about Ukraine and stuff like that. But it looks like Slovakia is one that's already gone to the right. I had one interaction on Spotify. Sexy Fingers replied to my question of what's pissing you off this week with, I can only make one fucking comment on your what's pissing you off. Because I have shitloads of things pissing me off. I hear you, Sexy Fingers, and thanks for the comment. If you enjoy this podcast, please tell a friend about it. Last week, I put The Critical Drinker in the title of the episode to see if that still got more people to listen to it, and it did. I'm not going to do that this week, so probably we'll just go back down. I'll tell you what happened if I remember. Politics and Donald J. Trump. Politics and Trump. I'm the anti-wopa. Some Joe wanted to do. It's anti-wopa podcast time. I keep forgetting to put in the election betting odds. So these numbers are from Wednesday. I just don't want to forget. But Joe Biden has made a comeback. I think Trump used to be up by a couple percent. It's all this stuff is very close to 50-50. But anyways, Biden's up now. Here we go. Who will win the 2024 U.S. presidential election? Joe Biden, 53. Donald Trump, 46. Gavin Newsom, 5. Robert Kennedy Jr., 6. Kamala Harris, 4. And these vice president numbers are not right because it leaves out important people like J.D. Vance. But anyways, who will win the 2024 Republican vice presidential nomination? Tim Scott, 24. Kristi Noem, 21. Tulsi Gabbard, 14. Elise Stefanik, 10. A bunch of other people. Inflation versus abortion. That may be what this election comes down to. And we just got the numbers for the last month of inflation. And inflation is up to 3.5%. It used to be 9, but people thought it was going to be down this month. It's up, or last month. So there's the theory that interest rates went up and that caused all the woke media companies to go out of business. And that's going to make Joe Biden lose the election. And the first 2 months of this year, they're like, yeah, inflation is a little too high, but we think it's coming down. So we think we're going to lower interest rates just in time for Joe Biden. But this third month being high is like, well, that's actually 3 months in a row of too high. Instead of, oh, just a couple months of out of whack, you know, oddball ones, it's like, oh, three in a row, this is a trend. And there had been talk of maybe cutting interest rates 4 times this year, really juicing the economy. And now people are starting to think maybe 0 cuts. Some people are even talking about maybe raising rates. I don't know. This is all from the All In podcast. They think the Arab countries with oil are not fond of Biden. Whatever. I thought they were, but anyways, not fond of Biden. And so they're cutting back on oil production, which makes oil expensive, which makes everything expensive, which raises inflation, which gets Trump elected. And, you know, when they ask in polling, they say, what's your number one thing? And people are like, the economy. So, you know, that's another way of saying inflation. And I mentioned maybe a month ago that the average American household is paying $300 extra a month in servicing their debt. Just, you know, mortgage, car payment, credit card payment. And apparently, servicing your debts used to be part of inflation. But then they didn't include that. So when inflation was 9.5% a couple years ago, or it's 3.5% now, that does not include the part where you're paying more for your debts. And apparently that 9.5% would have been 18% if you would have included your various payments. And now you know as much as I know. Not much. Abortion is in the news because Trump came out with his position on it. He had been saying he was going to make an announcement, and he did. And he said, let the states decide. Each state can make up its own rules. Which, you know, that's a position, I guess. It's also just the status quo. I mean, the facts on the ground, it's just how things are. And things are the way that they are because of the Supreme Court that Trump created. So if, you know, if he thinks the way it should be is that the states should decide abortion, then he did it. He already did it. It was him. He did it a while ago. He succeeded, you know, like, I think sometimes he says he built the wall, and he didn't really build the wall, but anyways, in this case, he did, you know, he made it so the states could decide, and he's achieved everything he ever wanted based on his preference, and basically, he'd like to move on now. He'd like to be president now. And so, for 50 years, the Supreme Court said states can't decide. Even, you know, federal Congress can't decide, which basically made it so politicians could just choose whatever sounds good. Basically, whatever they think will get them elected. And now the rubber is hitting the road. Like, for 50 years, the Republicans are like, hey, dumbass voter, I'm pro-life. Vote for me so I can give money to the rich. I can't do anything about pro-life stuff, but I'm pro-life, so vote for me. And then, you know, oh, I gave money to the rich again. Whoops, I fell and slipped my dick into your wife. Sorry. And there actually used to be a lot of pro-life Democrats who are like, well, I'm pro-life, but I can't change it. There's not so many of those anymore. So we're, you know, this election will tell us if Republicans are the dog that caught the car. You know, if a dog catches a car, grabs that bumper, the bumper's just going to rip the teeth out of the dog. But the number of abortions are actually up, so, you know, you can get it through the mail like you're ordering DoorDash. And normally people care about the economy, so we'll just have to see what the voters say. Yeah, so a couple thoughts. The Democrats under Biden, they've now become the pro-war, pro-military-industrial complex, pro-tax cuts for the rich. You know, pro give money to the rich straight out, even if it causes inflation and screws over the poor. Basically, they're pro the powerful, anti the weak. Which used to be the Republican position. So anyways, there's a realignment happening. And I wonder if Democrats start becoming more pro-life. Like, they've taken over all the stuff that, you know, George W. Bush Jr. was about. Except for the pro-life part. Are they just going to seal the deal or complete it? And maybe a little bit. I don't really think so, though, because the other thing is the Overton window is shifting. So Republicans in the Senate have been floating the idea of a national 15-week abortion ban. Can't get one after 15. Unless you are willing to lie about rape or incest, or your life is in jeopardy. So this nationwide 15-week ban, yeah, they came up with the idea maybe a year or two ago. And basically the question is, okay, a 15-week ban as opposed to what? Initially, pro-life people were like, you can't do a 15-week ban. We need to have a total ban. Or a heartbeat ban, which is like 6 weeks. But anyways, we need a more strict ban. But now, if you compare a 15-week ban versus let the states decide, that's a 15-week ban versus no ban at all. I mean, there may be a ban in some states, but like as far as the president and Congress doing some banning, they're doing no banning at all. So we'll see if, I mean, I think the politicians are kind of trying to make this happen. I mean, again, they don't care. I haven't seen any politician willing to stick their neck out. The only people willing to stick their neck out are the Supreme Court justices who have a lifetime appointment, so they're not sticking their neck out at all. But are we shifting to a 15-week ban is way too loose and that lets you just murder babies, to the pro-life position is we need a 15-week ban stat? And like, you know, European countries, France, Norway, I think all of them, all the most woke European countries, like they have like 13-week bans. So 15-week is, I don't know what, it's even more woke than what woke countries do. So are pro-life people going to be, I'm pro-life, we need a 15-week ban? And this is like the Israel situation where people on the far left are like, you're murdering the Palestinians, they hate what you're doing, Biden. And it's like, well, oh, you're going to go vote for Trump instead? And then pro-lifers are like, we need a total ban. It's like, oh, are you going to go vote for Biden instead? And so the other abortion news was, I think like 2 days after Trump said his thing, well, that's okay, we're not done with that. Basically, we don't know. If a 15-week ban goes across Trump's desk, will he sign it? So, you know, he's like, he's not talking about that. He doesn't really want to talk about that. But what he really doesn't want to talk about is, hey, Trump, if a total ban goes across your desk, will you sign it? Or a 6-week ban, will you sign it? And so I think, you know, now until the election, it's going to be people asking him that and him trying to avoid that, saying, oh, states decide. I already told you. But the other news was 2 days after Trump said his thing, the Arizona Supreme Court said that a like 1850 law that bans all abortion except for the life of the mother can go into effect. And they stayed it for 2 weeks, so we will find out, whatever, a week after you hear this, if it really happens. I don't think it's going to really happen. But so Arizona had recently done, I don't know, like 12 or 15-week ban themselves. But the bill didn't say, I think it was 12, but don't quote me. Anyway, the bill didn't say the ban is now 12 weeks and any other ban doesn't count. So basically, there's a total ban plus a 12-week ban. You double can't do it after 12 weeks, but you just can't do it, period, is how the current ruling is. And the Arizona Attorney General has said they're not going to prosecute anyone based on it. But I think local people, you know, a local sheriff can arrest someone and a local judge can try and throw, I think providers of abortion can get up to 5 years. So we'll see if that'll be a huge news story if anyone ever gets arrested for it. But if my realignment theory is correct, I think Republicans in Arizona are about to switch and pass a law making abortion more legal. Like, you know, maybe you could say, oh, the pro-life position is you just want to restrict it more. Like, you don't necessarily want a total ban, but, you know, pro-life is you want more restrictions. Pro-choice is less restrictions. Well, if the politicians in Arizona go, oh, pass another law that says, for instance, okay, it's a 12-week ban, and you can throw out any ban less than that, then, and I think the Republicans are in charge of the House and the Senate in Arizona. The governor is a Democrat who would sign it. Anyways, the Republicans would be on the pro-choice side of giving more More abortion. Abortions for all. Let's check in on Trump's trials. So I'm probably missing some, but I think there's 6 trials. There was 2 civil cases in New York. Trump lost both of those already. That was the false rape accusation, cost him $85 million, and then the lying about business stuff, $450 million. Then there's 2 state criminal cases, one in New York, one in Georgia. The New York one is over campaign finance stuff. It's considered to be not a legally correct way of doing stuff, but they're doing it anyways. And I think that's happening this month. And then there's the criminal one in Georgia, which was election interference. And that was where the DA was sleeping with her, the guy she hired to run the case. And I don't know where that one's at now. It's going to be a while if that one ever gets to court before the election. And then there's 2 federal criminal cases, which is January 6th and classified documents. So the January 6th one, that's the one that, you know, people would love to get trumped up on. And it's in Washington, D.C., where all the judges are like, yeah, we're going to railroad them. All the, you know, the entire population of D.C. is like, I'll be on that jury. I'll railroad them. But these white-collar federal criminal cases, the normal way for them to go is they just take forever. And like I say, everyone's ready to railroad them, except that it keeps going to the Supreme Court, which takes time. So I think people don't think that one's going to happen before the election. If he loses, they're going to do that one, and they're going to probably actually throw him in prison. But if he wins the election, he's fine. And then the classified documents case is in Florida, and that's where he has a judge that likes him. I don't know if that's exactly right, but I would say maybe 1 out of 6 cases, 1 out of 6 maybe lawyers in general support Trump. You know, 5 out of 6 would railroad the hell out of him. They'd throw the law in the trash, take a diarrhea shit on top of it, and say, he's worse than Hitler. I had to throw every bit of integrity and morals I ever had built up from my parents, throw it all in the trash to stop the next Hitler. And then 1 in 6 is like, I don't hate the guy. You know, we're going to go by the law. I mean, you know, they're not like totally in the bag for him. But so Jack Smith is the special prosecutor, and basically he's been fighting with the Florida judge and in, you know, legalese, calling her an idiot. There's something called the Presidential Records Act, which I think, like, for instance, Reagan had some classified documents at his house, and they were like, you know what, that's his personal documents, it's fine. And I think, and I don't know if the act's, I don't know how the act actually works with this exactly. But anyways, and I think maybe Clinton also was allowed to keep some classified stuff. Oh, that's your personal stuff. It's fine. So obviously Trump is like, oh, well, all that stuff is my personal stuff. It's fine. And so the question is, does the Presidential Records Act apply to this case? Because if it does, then it's fine. But if it doesn't apply at all, if you don't tell the jury that this thing exists, then the jury will convict him. And that's the thing that most people don't know. I didn't know until, you know, last couple of years about court cases. I think I learned about this, I don't know, maybe the Kyle Rittenhouse or the George Floyd trial. But basically, before the jury gets to do anything, the judge tells them what they're deciding. Like, you can go either way on this, but here's the thing that you're going on. Like, the judge could say, if this person has held their breath for the last 20 years, then they're innocent. But if they have taken one breath of air in the last 20 years, then you must convict them. And then it goes to the jury, and you're like, well, it was up to the jury the whole time. But you can see, like, if given that instructions, in that case, that's an exaggerated case, the jury would always convict. They're like, oh, he took a breath. And so, you know, that example is too obvious. But anyways, judges can dress it up in legalese if they want. And, you know, reminder, usually judges dress stuff up so that every poor person who goes into court gets convicted. But anyways, the judge is like, I don't know, I might use this Presidential Records Act in the jury instructions. And Jack Smith is like, judge, you're so stupid, I'm going to appeal this right away. I'm already writing the appeal. As soon as you make your stupid decision, I'm gonna send this appeal off. And basically, you do not want to piss off the judge, which that's almost designed to piss her off. And that's where we're at. We shall see. But one other thing is that she doesn't necessarily have to, well, she doesn't have to tell the lawyers the jury instructions until after the jury has been selected. And if you get to that point, then there's no changing anything. So if she's mad, she can either slow walk the whole thing and just make it take what would basically be a normal amount of time. They're trying to speed everything up to make it, you know, political election rigging. Or she can impanel the jury and then do it then. And another thing. So, it's been said that Trump's lawyers are all a bunch of idiots. And then the people on the Advisory Opinions podcast are like, no, he's got some great lawyers. And I think the answer is, up until recently, all of Trump's lawyers were idiots. And that's because, basically, that, you know, you'd be disbarred. If you worked for Donald Trump, you would be disbarred. All right, this is Lawfare. This is the legal part of election rigging. Every big firm was like, we won't hire you. You'll be blacklisted from ever working at a big firm ever again. You know, all the Democrat-controlled state bar associations will attempt to disbar you. Now, you know, who's dumb enough to go work for Donald Trump? Oh, Donald Trump got a dumb lawyer. And I think those are the kind of lawyers he had who were like, oh yeah, we can, whatever the thing he wanted to do the election, he was getting it from those dumb lawyers. But say you're a lawyer who's made tens of millions of dollars and you're old, you know, what would you want? You know, basically, everyone wants to be rich and famous. Well, you're rich now. And I was always like, doesn't some lawyer want to be famous? I mean, you could go down in history, right? These are going to be court cases that are in the history books and certainly in the law school books. So the answer is yes. Some good lawyers have finally done it. One of them was the top lawyer for the state of Texas. Another guy was a district attorney for the state of New York, which is, you know, that's the Manhattan one. That's super top dog. Like, they kind of do nationwide stuff in New York. And what's funny, the New York, I think he's a federal attorney. He was a lifelong Democrat. He switched to being a Republican and then went and worked for Donald Trump. He's like, yes, I've achieved everything you could possibly ever achieve, except I want to be in every law book. I want every freshman lawmaker to have to read about me, or lawyer. So fine, I'll switch to being a Republican and take these cases. And he's looking like a genius because he's making the courts do what they've always done in every single other case, which is the stuff just moves slowly, and that's all he has to do. He doesn't really have to win the cases. That part doesn't matter. It's just, can you get them to not railroad him? And it seems like he can so far. Okay, so turns out Trump's trial starts on Monday. Basically, when you hear this, it's on. It's expected to last 6 weeks. Trump has to actually show up in person, and they start with jury selection. Talking about the ladies, and possibly things that would interest the ladies.
Yes, women, girls, come gather round. It's anti-woke time. Talking about ladies in an anti-woke.
Can't decide if this segment should be about women or if it should be about things that are of interest to women. Kind of like the difference between the old magazines Playboy or Hustler versus Cosmopolitan and possibly Boy's Life. But on the Feminine Chaos podcast, they bring up the term sexually adventurous. And can this only apply to women or to men too? Apparently it applies to gay men, and it means promiscuous. It means you might be about to get the monkeypox. But men are supposed to be down for whatever kind of sex they can get, whatever they're allowed. So you don't say they're real adventurous if they're like, hey, you want to have sex? Yeah. Oh, wow, you're so adventurous. But for women, I think because it's more risky physically and emotionally. And so, you know, adventure like skydiving or something, it's not supposed to be something necessarily that you want to do, but you want to try it, and it's risky. You want to have the experience. And the example they bring up is a straight woman who maybe would partake in a threesome. That's what I have to say about that. But so that last minute, that was for women. That was a topic that should be interesting to women. Now I'm going to talk about women. So I think like 18% of my listeners are women. So just skip ahead a minute. We're going to talk about you, ladies. But I frequently bring up evolutionary psychology and biology and how it affects the sexes and how men and women aren't different. And, you know, like with sex, only one sex gets pregnant and then has to raise a kid. So it's a lot easier for men than for women to, whatever. The pregnancy is much easier for men, especially if you're not around or you're, you know, in the old days, you're the chieftain with a bunch of concubines. But I just want to remind myself, yeah, so it's physically risky or, you know, has a large commitment or is impactful. But I don't talk about the emotional part of it much. And I'm not going to do it here, but this is just a reminder to myself. You know, why are the emotions so different? Like the stereotype is that women do not want men to cheat on them emotionally. And men do not want women to cheat on them sexually. And then the next thing they're talking about is heirlooms. And they tell a story of some guy on Reddit who's describing when him and his wife went to see the in-laws. And the mother-in-law has four sets of china. And she told the various kids, okay, each of you kids, pick the set of china that you want when I'm gone, when I'm dead. And the kids were like, all of them, we don't want your china. And then the guy's wife is like, hey, we're eating right now off of the normal plates and bowls. You know, in the 20 years I've known you, I've never seen you get that china out of the cupboard. And the mother was like, oh, no, we eat it for Christmas. She's like, I've been here for every Christmas. We've never used that china. If you give it to me, I'm going to use it for a Frisbee. And so the question is, what do you do with the stuff? You know, basically boomers, when they pass away and they leave you these beautiful mahogany cupboards and china and whatnot. I mean, like my dad has offered, like, hey, you want this thing that I got from my mom? And like my grandma, she only bought absolutely beautiful, expensive furniture like in the 50s or something. And the answer is, I don't want it. Like I got a crappy, whatever piece of furniture that she has that's been passed down and might get passed to me, like I have a crappy version of it. And I like the crappy version because if I mess it up, who cares? I can throw it away. I mean, china would be the worst. Like you want this valuable, fragile thing that you never use and takes up a lot of room. I mean, stuff that you don't use, stuff that you have to store in a way costs you money. Like if you take it to the extreme, you know, some people have to go and get a storage unit and they pay $300 a month or something to store items. And so, like, you know, those are literally costing you money every month. But just in general, stuff that you store is just taking up room that some other stuff could have been there. So, you know, it's a cost. And there's no woke, anti-woke outrage on this subject. It just, I think what has happened is in the old days, and I mean, when I was a kid, so that was what, the 70s and the 80s. People did not have as much stuff as they wanted. But today, people have too much stuff. Like darning socks. I'm not sure how you spell darn, but if you get a hole in your sock, I think you get a darning needle and you darn your socks and you fix them. And that's because way back in the day, you only had like two pairs of socks, so you better fix them. But now no one darns anymore. I'm not even sure that's how you say it. Well, this podcast, they say the solution is you just lie and say, oh, I'd love to have that thing. And then when they're dead, you give it to Goodwill. And hopefully they don't go, oh, well, you know, you said you wanted that thing. We're moving to a smaller house in Florida, so why don't you drive up and get that dresser? And I'll say for me, so that one grandma who had nice stuff, she had a bunch of sterling silver stuff. And so she talked to all her relatives and said, okay, who gets what? She asked me, I was like, well, I'll take, she had this thing, I don't know, it was for like presenting a turkey. It had like a lid that could fold back. It was huge. It was just this huge thing made out of pure silver. I was like, I'll take that thing. And I think I might have been the first one to choose. And she's like, oh no, but I decided that's going to someone else. And then there was a snuff box from a relative in the 1850s or something. I was like, well, that's kind of cool. You know, snuff, that's manly. It's small. You're not, whatever, going to make sure you can't have it because you're going to melt it down. Anyways, I was like, I'll take the snuff box. But then whatever system she had for doing that, I think that was her memory. She's like, I will remember who this stuff goes to when they're dead. And anyways, the stuff got divvied up, given out. I didn't get any of the silver, didn't get the snuff box. And unfortunately, the snuff box went to a far-off relative who wasn't, you know, wasn't someone I knew close enough to say, hey, that was supposed to be mine. It basically would have been, hey, stranger, give me that silver thing. Little update here, wedding china. That's where all that china comes from. Back in the day, when you got married, as a gift, you got china. China. Makes me think of this YouTube video I watched where a guy bought a mammoth tusk from a woolly mammoth. And then he like sanded it and polished it and made it a display item in his house. And it cost him $7,500 for it. Which to me, I was like, wow, I didn't know you could get a woolly mammoth tusk for, you know, $7,500. Anyways, the video also covers him talking to his wife about it. Like, she thinks the value of that mammoth tusk is $0. She could not care less about a woolly mammoth tusk. Well, in fact, she actively dislikes it. And somehow that just evolutionary biology over the last 100,000 years, men who collected valuable things were able to pass on their DNA to the next generation, and women who cared about collecting valuable things, it didn't help them pass on their DNA at all. Well, speaking of socks, so Mike Pesca on his The Gist podcast mentioned how he had another podcast called Not Even Mad. And it was an attempt to see if you could have people from the left and on the right on the same podcast. I mean, the right-wing person wasn't even a Trump supporter. And the concept was, sure, you could do that, and you wouldn't even get mad about it. So it was called Not Even Mad. But then the left-wing person got mad about it anyways and blew the whole thing up. But he mentions there's this other podcast he likes called Too Far. Too Far with whatever these ladies' names are. And it's two women who don't like each other. And so I decided to check it out. And the first thing they talk about in the first episode I listen to is arguing about socks. Here's a clip.
I didn't understand that. I thought it was arrive at 4. I assumed start 4:10, 4:15. Personally,
waiting outside, freezing. So anyway, my feet are wet. I'm holding.
Well, I ended therapy early to let you in.
Fine.
Okay. So you're welcome.
Okay.
Okay. So she comes in. She's wet. She's cold. And you know what? I'm sorry, but it's like, okay. Or you're wet. You're cold. You don't have an umbrella.
No, I don't have an umbrella. I'm just.
You're not dressed warm.
I don't feel like purchasing an umbrella for 2 days that it's raining and then being done with the umbrella. I'm going to fly the umbrella back with me to LA. If you don't live there, you don't have an umbrella.
But I'm just saying then, don't blame me for your circumstances.
Nobody's blaming.
Okay,
but
fabulous.
What happens when a friend, a colleague, comes to your house cold in the rain? What's something? Okay,
I said, Robbie, you want a blanket?
I said, if I take my shoes off, my feet will be wet.
Her shoes are wet. I'm not letting wet shoes
she
into
goes,
my apartment.
She started very good. She said, oh, do you need new socks? I said, you know what? A pair of dry socks. My extremities are so good. Then we get into the socks. No, I can't take these socks. I can't take
because
them.
She, wait, hold on. Because I said, you're going to take them, right? You're not giving them back to me.
Yeah, when you lend a pair of socks
no.
to a friend.
So I'm not giving you my Nike driver. Socks. I have a collection of socks
that
I wear.
Do you remember what I gave Richie?
Now here's where
Balenciaga shirt.
That is a nice gift.
And then there's another thing I gave you from the last thing. What was it?
Hold on. But But I'm not coming and demanding any of these things. I'm not saying give me that thing you have.
You offered socks, and then you and then
yes, and I
you
gave
took
you socks, and they weren't good enough for you.
No,
I gave
you
a pair.
Fake warm socks. You said these are warm, and you know they're not warm.
They are warm. You didn't even try them on.
I didn't talk about Ukraine or Israel last week. I think first time I haven't done that in a long time. So Ukraine, not too much is going on. Ukraine is still having some success blowing up big, expensive Navy ships of Russia. And Russia seems to be having success penetrating the aerial defense of Ukraine. And they've been blowing up power generation infrastructure, I think cutting off electricity to big swaths of cities in Ukraine. And Mike Johnson, the Republican, is getting real antsy to, who's in charge of the House, is getting real antsy to send money to Ukraine. But it hasn't happened yet. Well, and also, MAGA Republicans stopped the reauthorization of FISA this week. What's that? It's a thing that lets the intelligence agencies spy on the American public, and it helps them when they want to rig an election. And it expires every so often. They want to reauthorize it for 5 years. There's some talk that they can keep using it for 1 year, one more year, even if they don't reauthorize it, basically long enough to rig this election. Well, anyways, let's put it this way. So Mike Johnson, the head Republican who controls the House of Representatives, all he cares about are two things. He wants to send money to Ukraine, and he wants to rig the election so that Biden wins. Why the hell would he have those positions when his voters are the opposite? Well, that's because that's what the military-industrial complex wants. And the deep state and the blob. And then Israel, we're still waiting to see if they're going to do another ground invasion. Same old, but here's just some more information. So there's like 120 or something hostages left in Gaza. I think six of them are American. And I don't understand this, but there was talk about releasing 40 hostages in exchange for maybe a ceasefire or something. Doesn't matter what it was in exchange for. But the answer is they no longer have 40 non-military age male hostages. Like, you know, they had a bunch of women and kids, and they let a lot of the women and kids go. And then they were supposed to have more than 40 women and kids left. But so many of them had died while they're being held hostage that they don't have 40 of them anymore. So trading hostages for ceasefires is going to be tricky. And then I looked up, how many Americans live in Israel? The answer is 500,000. So Israel is, I mean, you know, it has, that's probably more Americans than live in Washington, D.C. It's almost as many Americans as live in, I think Wyoming is the least populous state. I mean, what's the city in Wyoming? Jackson Hole? Like, you know, Tel Aviv probably has more Americans living in it than Jackson Hole. And I think Britain has more than 500,000 Americans living in it. Somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000. Maybe Canada is similar. But basically, except for, you know, those big English-speaking countries that we're super close to, Israel has a very large number of Americans and a huge amount compared to the size of Israel. And so it's kind of like they're one of our states. And Jews are rich, if you haven't heard. So it makes them powerful. And the last couple weeks, Israel-Gaza was kind of blowing up the Daily Wire. I heard it said three ways. The Daily Israel Wire, the Daily Jewish Wire, and the Israeli Wire. Anyways, take your pick. But it seems like all that is dying down. There's supposed to be a Candace Owens, Ben Shapiro debate. Maybe that'll get people riled up again, but I don't think so. Basically, the question was, like, on the left, the Palestinian thing has just divided them crazy amounts and made a lot of powerful Jews switch from woke to anti-woke. And was that going to happen on the right? It doesn't look like it's going to happen on the right. I mean, people on the right do not want to go be on the side of Muslims. Well, update, Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House of Representatives, brought the FISA bill that allows the intelligence agencies to spy on Trump. He let it go to the floor, and Democrats and Republicans got together and passed it. And it was a tied vote, except for the Speaker of the House, who broke the tie and made it pass. So But basically, all the politicians know it's an evil bill. No one wanted to vote for it if they didn't have to, so exactly the number of people who had to do the evil thing did it, letting the other people pretend they're good. And if any of the evil people had dropped out, one of the good persons would have switched to the evil side, obviously. And so this is a clear signal that Mike Johnson, the next thing he's going to do is get together with Joe Biden and pass the Ukraine funding bill. And it only takes a few MAGA Republicans to make him kick him out of his job, and then we got to go through the whole process of picking a new speaker. I don't think they're going to do that. I mean, who knows? Maybe they'll let him pass the Ukraine thing and then kick him out of the job. Even MAGA people are bought and sold and paid for by the military-industrial complex. And some Republicans, non-MAGA ones, they're so into Ukraine funding that they would be willing to vote for a Democrat if they kick this guy out and then it goes to whatever, you know, the Democrats put someone forward, which would normally lose because they're in the minority, but I think they would actually win. And then instead of having a wolf in sheep's clothing, you would just have a wolf that looks like a wolf. You'd have a Democrat doing what Biden wants, which I would prefer. And basically, these things are happening fast, like the TikTok ban or whatever. That was just another thing to try and stop Trump from getting elected. I think they put that together and passed it like in 3 days because quick, before people figure it out. And this FISA thing was real quick. So I think the Ukraine thing is coming real quick. Another update, Iran sent a bunch of drones and missiles into Israel. Apparently the first time Iran has ever directly attacked Israel like that. And I'm speaking now on Sunday. We won't know what this really means until later in the week. But apparently, all the drones and missiles arrived at the same time. So the drones had to be sent out 3 hours ahead of time. And then cruise missiles take an hour to get there, so they were sent out a couple hours later. And then ballistic missiles only take 15 minutes to get there, so they were sent out right before the rest of the stuff arrived. Which is to say, they knew the ballistic missiles were... They knew that they saw the drones were launched 2 hours and 45 minutes before the ballistic missiles. So it gave them about 3 hours to get ready. Like Iran was like, hey, we're sending stuff. Don't let this kill a bunch of your people and start a giant war. I mean, we don't know, but it seems like that's... It seems like Iran didn't actually want to kill anyone. They're sending a message because Israel bombed one of their generals or something the other week. And something similar happened between America and Iran. I'm not sure what America did. I think maybe we bombed one of their generals. This is, you know, a couple of years ago or more. And then Iran told America, we're about to blow up one of your military bases, maybe in Iraq or somewhere. And basically, America got everyone out of the base, and then Iran blew up the building, not killing anyone. So it seems like Iran doesn't want to get into a giant fight, particularly with America. Sometimes it seems like Israel would like America and Iran to fight. For you truckers out there who need some extra content, here's an old segment from, I think, 2021. Twitter handle, @religionofwoke. Did you know that when you were screwing over poor whites, you're also disproportionately screwing over blacks? Well, I don't know what disproportionate means, but that sounds nice. Real nice. All right, let's take a look at redlining. So redlining is, well, I'll describe it here in a second, but, you know, my whole life, such that I heard about redlining, it was just a racist thing to, whatever, to prevent blacks from being able to leave their neighborhoods and or buy homes. So I'm going to read a little thing here from Wikipedia, so that we know what it is, and then we'll have an interesting fact here at the end. In 1935, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board asked the Homeowners Loan Corporation to look at 239 cities and create, in quotes, residential security maps to indicate the level of security for real estate investment in each surveyed city. On the maps, the newest areas, those considered desirable for lending purposes, were outlined in green and known as Type A. These are typically affluent suburbs on the outskirts of cities. Type B neighborhoods, outlined in blue, were considered still desirable, whereas older Type C were labeled declining and outlined in yellow. Type D neighborhoods were outlined in red and were considered the most risky for mortgage support. While about 85% of the neighborhoods were white, while about 85% of the residents of such neighborhoods were white, they included most of the African American urban households. And so John McWhorter gives a similar stat, I guess the 30s and the 40s, so I don't know about the 50s, but through the 40s, 82% of the residents in those in the redlined districts, you know, neighborhoods, were white. But, you know, it was disproportionate to African Americans, and so 97% of African Americans, I guess, lived in those neighborhoods. Must not be counting rural stuff. I guess 97% of the African Americans in those cities where they did any lining whatsoever lived in the redlined areas. So basically, I mean, it's not good that they were denying mortgage support. I guess what? They help you get a mortgage. If you don't normally deserve a mortgage, the federal government would step in and help you get a mortgage. This is part of the Big New Deal. And so, but if you lived in these areas, I think basically it was like, it was an early form of credit rating. And they were like, don't loan to the people who live in these bad neighborhoods because they won't pay it back. And obviously, you know, just living in a neighborhood doesn't mean you don't pay back your loans. But they didn't have credit ratings back then. And that was their attempt. Like, you know, what are we going to, how are we going to figure out who we can loan to and who will pay back their loans? And they came up with this thing. They said, okay, just people from this, people from there, they're more likely to not pay it back, so don't loan to them. But I guess the point is, like, the only thing I ever heard about redlining, yeah, was about how it screwed over black people. There's absolutely no mention that, you know, basically the vast majority of the people who were redlined were white. I mean, I think basically what it was is they came up with this idea. They were not thinking about race whatsoever. There's a million things like this. You know, you're not thinking about race and how and disproportionate impact, right? They probably hadn't invented the term disproportionate impact back then. So they're just like, oh yeah, those poor neighborhoods, blah, blah. And no one was like, oh, do you know that's where the black people live? And then that's going to make it disproportionate. They were just like, this will work. You know, maybe some of them had racist ideas. I bet it just didn't occur to them. They're like, those poor people, screw them. But again, it's just a much more complicated situation than, you know, I was told. Like, so Wikipedia had that 85% of the people were white. And so, like, I went on Wikipedia's article on redlining. It's freaking huge. You know, it's probably 40 paragraphs or who knows what. And basically, because I had heard that a lot of white people were in the neighborhood, so I wanted to see what Wiki said. And so I searched the page for white, and it's like, you know, 50 or 100 times the word white is used in the article. And it's all, I think, you know, other than that one that one statement, I mean, it's towards the top, to their credit. But other than that one statement that says 85% of them are white, every other time that, you know, the other 99 times they use the word white in there is whatever, just to say how whites are bad. You know, this was a thing by whites against blacks. And apparently, it's much more complicated. Like, I think we can all agree that if you're a white person and you're a, whatever, grandpa and great or great-grandpa lived in a redlined area, you probably don't deserve reparations. But kind of the way reparations, you know, the argument for reparations, it's kind of like you go, okay, we, you know, black people deserve reparations because of slavery. And then some people are like, well, you know, no black people today were alive during slavery. And in fact, you know, it's been 150 years since slavery ended. So then you might be like, well, you know, Jim Crow. You know, that means we, you know, we got to have some reparations. And it's like, well, there's a few super old people that lived under that in the South, but most of the country didn't even have Jim Crow. So, you know, how are we going to work that out? And, you know, that and most of the Jim Crow stuff happened, whatever, 100 years ago and more. Actually, I don't know. Where did that go? It went from 1865 to 1960, maybe. So anyways, a lot of it happened a long time ago. Some of it happened more recently. So anyways, the third little leg of this stool, this reparations stool, is redlining. So basically, people have a pretty intense incentive to talk about redlining as a purely racist attack on black wealth. You know, therefore, reparations are justified. And whatever, when you've got that incentive, when you're trying to use it to make that particular point, you got to leave out all the white people. And I think I described how redlining works incorrectly. I thought about it for a second. It wasn't people from this neighborhood don't loan to them. It was houses in that neighborhood don't loan to anyone who wants to buy those houses. Or sorry, not loan, but the federal government was like, we're not gonna help you get a mortgage if you're buying a house in the redlined area. And so I guess most people want to buy a house in the neighborhood that they live in. So, you know, basically, if you're like, I'm leaving the red line neighborhood, I'm going to the green line neighborhood, I think the federal government's like, sweet, we'll help you out. But if you're like, I live in the red line area and I want to buy a house in the same area that I live in, they're like, we're not going to help you. I mean, I think that makes it sounds like one of those unintended consequences. So, like, basically, the white people, I mean, I'm sure a lot of them wanted to stay in their neighborhood. Who knows? They've, you know, their family's been living there for generations. But, basically, this redlining stuff, which was, you know, it was help, right? It wasn't like they made things worse for you. It was just how much help they gave you. So, anyways, they would give you more and more help if you would leave the poor neighborhoods. And so I haven't heard this stat yet. Like, did black people want to leave their neighborhoods less, so they left them less, so they got less help leaving than white people? I mean, I don't know. Basically, it's just get out of that poor neighborhood and we'll help you. And then, oh, well, that neighborhood you want to get out of has a disproportionate amount of black people. I don't know. It's kind of weird. I mean, I guess the suburbs were considered the good part of town back then. And, like, I don't know. Did black people want to move to the suburbs? Or they're like, I don't want to move to the suburbs. It's all white people. Or what? I'd like to know what they were what your average African-American resident of a redlined neighborhood thought about the suburbs back then. Or maybe the suburb houses were just too expensive, out of their range. I'm not sure. All right, some more information. So it sounds like, you know, Roosevelt, he wasn't like a raging racist who wanted to hurt black people. He was trying to, I think I called it the Big New Deal. It's just the New Deal, not the Big Deal or the Big New Deal, the New Deal. But, you know, he was just trying to, whatever, help poor people. And, you know, he's trying to take from the rich and give to the poor. And he's considered, you know, one of the top presidents ever for doing that stuff, Social Security, etc. But Glenn Lowry, he points out that, you know, how did they choose these neighborhoods to be redlined? Well, I mean, to start with, they chose poor neighborhoods. But it sounds like maybe, you know, neighborhoods could change. Maybe they could get out of the red or back, or get, you know, they could go up in colors or down in colors. And if black people started moving to a white neighborhood, it was more likely to get a red line around it. So that ain't right. I don't think that's right. No one thinks that's right. So Glenn Lowry is talking to David Kaiser. They're both highfalutin professors. And David Kaiser is a historian, and he's, in not so many words, talking about how history got woke. You know, historians and the books. You know, you might think like, oh, history, it just... history happened a certain way, and that's the end of it. But in fact, you know, history is written by the victors, or it's written by whoever writes the book. And, you know, you can make people look good or bad. You know, it's up to you, whoever writes the book. So the first time things got woke was, so after World War II, and for about, for the next 20 years, you know, historians and everyone agreed that, America was great and, you know, Russia was bad. Then the Vietnam War happened and people were like basically rewriting history to say, oh, that whole time, you know, that whole time that we've been doing the Cold War with Russia since, you know, 45 to 65 or whatever, America was actually the evil one. Like, we dropped the bomb, you know, we dropped the nuke on Japan to show Russia that they better sit down and shut up ever after. And so, you know, I don't really care who's right, you know, was America in the right or was America in the wrong back then? It doesn't really matter. I think the important point to me is that, so for 20 years, the historians were writing their history with one viewpoint, and then historians changed their mind and started writing the opposite, you know? You know, one guy would write a book that America's great, and then the next, you know, another guy, then they'd be writing a book about how America's terrible. So basically, they're not going by the facts. Either America was great, or it was terrible, or it was something in between, but historians don't actually tell you the truth. They just go by their own opinion. And so Kaiser mentions an interesting fact about this. Like, so if, you know, if you're writing a, you know, if you're at a highfalutin college writing history papers or books, you got to have footnotes. And so, you know, if you're there when you just switch, like, you know, you're switching to America is evil. Well, I mean, all the sources that you're going to be taking from are going to be about how America is great. And so what they do is they just misrepresent the sources, you know? They, like, you know, some book that said America was great, they write, America was evil. See this book from 10 years ago. But in fact, that's not what the book said. So not only is it all just opinion, but they will, basically, they'll lie about it. I mean, that's what you got to do. Or else you got to start writing books without any sources and recreate the whole thing from scratch, which, you know, that would have been the honest thing to do, but... Anyways, honesty is, whatever, not to be found in academia, even back then, I guess. And so what's going on in history departments and universities across the country today? I mean, it's the same old thing. It used to be, you know, objectivity was what you strived for. Like, no one's objective, but you can try and be objective. But anyways, that's been thrown in the trash, and the idea now is that there is no objective truth. There's just different opinions, and the validity of those opinions is based on, you know, the race and gender and sexual orientation of the person speaking. And so you might think that's like, oh, well, a black person can stand up and say, I feel this is how history went. And then everyone's like, all right, that's how history went. I mean, and that is kind of true. But really, right, these, you know, these highfalutin universities, it's all white people. The professors are white. So it's basically just a bunch of stolen valor where the white professor is like, I'm speaking on behalf of marginalized groups. I'm speaking on behalf of women. You know, some man will be like, I'm speaking on behalf of women. And that's why you have to believe what I'm saying. And some white woman is like, I'm speaking on behalf of black men. So that's why you have to believe what I'm saying. Kind of funny, really. And sad. And so the context these guys are talking about is the case against the case for reparations. And they're talking about the New Deal, I think Roosevelt 30s. Social Security, for instance, got implemented or created. And one thing that happened with Social Security was it basically was for factory workers. It was not for farm workers, which a lot of black people were. It was not for domestic workers, you know, like maids, which I guess black people also were. It also wasn't for professional people, so, you know, whatever, lawyers and doctors, they did not get Social Security initially. And so there's a narrative, you know, there's a very strong narrative that you better not go against, otherwise you will get fired, that the reason why they kept out the farm workers and the domestic workers was because Roosevelt had to make a deal with the Southerners to get the whole thing passed, and the Southerners were racist as hell, and they wanted to, whatever, You know, the Southerners were racist, and probably a bunch of America was racist, and so racist-ass America wanted to hurt black people, and so that's why they kept out farm workers and domestic workers. And it's true, they did keep them out for, I'm not sure, 50s. Anyways, everyone got covered starting somewhere in the 50s, so for 10, 20 years. But this one guy's point is that for every black worker in that in those categories, there was two or three white people in those categories, white workers. And so he doesn't think that, whatever, the Southerners or the people who went along with what the Southerners wanted. The Southerners hated the unions, I guess, is part of it. Somehow that played a part. But he doesn't think the Southerners hated black people so much that they were like screwing over a bunch of white people that they loved. It was just, they didn't let, you know, whatever. It was poor people. They were screwing over poor people, most of whom were white, and that was just how they liked it. But this becomes relevant when you start talking about reparations, because motive, you know, what was the motive? Like, if people were hurting black people on purpose, it gives a much stronger claim for reparations than if, oh, you know, you got caught up in this thing where we were trying to take down a bunch of poor whites. And so I guess, you know, maybe some of these things were maybe because of racism, but mostly it's just that there's more whites. It's just white, you know, America had more white people. So basically, black people were just getting caught up in stuff. You know, white against white. Hey, that's how we like it. I guess maybe, like today, they'd be like, hey, this is going to disproportionately hurt black people, even though it's intended for whites. And then we would change our minds about that. But back then, I guess that was the racism back then. The racism back then was, while you're taking down your white enemies, if that took down the blacks too, you didn't give a F. All right, another thing from back then was the GI Bill. And there was black veterans and white veterans, and things did not, whatever, things ended up being disproportionate. So what's going on there? So basically, one of the things it could do was it would pay for you to go to college. And apparently, maybe 24% of white veterans and 15% of black veterans used it to go to college. So, you know, obviously that ain't equal. Disparate outcomes there. So, okay, the guy hasn't said yet if the GI Bill itself is racist. But going on back then in the South, the universities were segregated. I think that's why a lot of the black, you know, the historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, I think they're in the South. And that must have been because black people couldn't go to a white university back in the day in the South. So they created their own. And that's almost like now today, the South has got a bunch of nice black universities, I think, or at least several nice black universities where they don't have that anywhere else in the country. Maybe the southern part of the Midwest or southern part of the East Coast. But anyways, things are not fair for black people back then. I mean, whatever. If things ain't fair, things ain't fair. I'm against unfairness, so I guess I'm against what happened here was segregated colleges in the South, and then a lot of colleges had like a, you know, whatever. You had to prove that you were a college material back then, so I don't think they had the SAT, but probably had to be a high school graduate or something like that. And so black people had a lower percentage of them being high school graduates and whatnot. I mean, I don't think white people were doing that great back then either. All right, so that was going on. It doesn't sound like the GI Bill was unfair in itself. Like, you know, all veterans are eligible for it. But you're like, hey, you can go to college if you can get in. Well, you know, I don't know. What should they have said instead of you can go to college and we'll pay for it if you can get in? I guess maybe they should have had affirmative action is what a woke person today would say. So maybe they should have. Well, that's the end of the episode. Links in the description, and thanks for listening.